Good morning, everyone. We're going ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary together and to order. Thank you very much for being here this morning. We have an informational hearing that we're going to be going over, actually two, and we're going to break this up. So if you have your agenda, we'll be starting at the top. We have no work session for introduction of committee measures. So we'll start off with the Youth Authority. Then we have a public hearing and work session on a bill from the Youth Authority, and then we'll go into our next informational hearing and take up the DLC proposed legislation. So with that, I will welcome those from the Oregon Youth Authority, Fairbowls and Joe. I think you two are up. And thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. For the record, Fairbowls Paksuresh, Director of Oregon Youth Authority, and with me, Joe O'Leary, our Deputy Director. We're going to, in the short time that we have, to go through just a very brief overview of the juvenile justice system in Oregon. We do a quick overview of Oregon, Oregon Youth Authority, talk about the youth who we serve, and then talk about our strategic initiatives, and we'll finish with 2017 legislative issues, and we'll go back and forth between Joe and I, so I'll turn it over to him to start with the agency presentation.
Chair Prozanski, members of the Judiciary Committee, good morning. For the record, Joe O'Leary, as a Judiciary Council alum, it's already always great to be back in this hearing room with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Another graduate from the Judiciary Committee.
I've heard that you've had a string of us lately, so thanks for getting us all out of the way early. This first slide is really a big picture overview of the juvenile justice system in Oregon, and the Oregon Youth Authority, our agency, is of course a small part, though an important part, of the overall juvenile justice system in the state. There are about 400,000 young people in Oregon, ages about 10 to 18, but very, very few of them end up becoming involved in the state's juvenile justice system. There are about 8,000 delinquency referrals in a given year, and this is a year snapshot for 2015. And of those 8,000 referrals of delinquent behavior, only about 2,700 young people end up adjudicated of delinquent behavior. And of them, only about 500 end up being committed to the Oregon Youth Authority. When a youth is before the court in juvenile court, the judge can do two things with respect to a commitment to OYA. The judge can commit the youth to an OYA close custody facility, and I'll have a slide here that shows you where those are, or the court can commit the youth to probation, which is to say removing the youth from the home but placing the youth usually in a residential program. I'll also show you a map of our residential programs, or a foster or proctor program. But you'll see the lion's share of juvenile justice work in the state really falls on the shoulders of the 36 independent juvenile departments, who are our important partners in juvenile justice around the state. This also shows you that about 100 youth in this given year come to OYA's physical care, not from the juvenile courts of the state, but rather by virtue of Measure 11 and charging decisions that are made and resulting convictions in adult court because of the seriousness of the underlying offenses. Those youth are considered adults, though they may be 15, 16, or 17, and in legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but placed in the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. Our mission is pretty simple. It is focused on public safety and reformation. Those are the two pillars that underlie what we do. And our vision, which we take very seriously, goes beyond reducing recidivism. We do want our youth to be crime-free when they leave our care, but we also feel the importance of having them be productive. We want them to be educated. We want them to be skilled. We want them to be ready to be productive members of their communities, which 99% of them will return to. A little bit of history and perspective. As most of you know, the Oregon Youth Authority is a creature of statute. We were created in 1995. Prior to that, juvenile justice lived in the Children's Services Division of the child welfare system. Under the leadership of then Attorney General Governor Kulongoski, Senate Bill 1 was passed in 1995, which created the Oregon Youth Authority. And it also put into place the sentencing scheme that I mentioned, which creates the system where youth who are treated in adult court but who committed their offenses before 18 are placed in the physical custody of the Youth Authority until age 25. Senate Bill 1 also raised the age of maximum jurisdiction. It had previously been 21, and it raised it to 25, so that the young people who were caught up in the mandatory minimum sentences as applied to youth would be given a meaningful opportunity for education and reformation. A little bit about the youth we serve. As I mentioned, the youngest commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority can be as young as 12 years old, and jurisdiction tops out at 25. All offenses have got to be committed before 18 for a youth to be considered placed in our custody. And I've already talked about these two different buckets of kids that come to us, those that come through the juvenile courts and those that come through the adult system. A little bit about our funding and structure, about the agency itself. We have 11 close custody facilities around the state. As you know, we are soon to be closing the Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility in Salem. That's part of a consolidation that's been in the works for about 2 years. Hillcrest is slated to be closed in July. As you know, the governor's proposed budget and the co-chair's framework calls for the closing of the North Coast Youth Correctional Facility in Warrenton. So that 11 may soon be 9. We have 26 field offices where our juvenile parole and probation officers work out of around the state, 19 residential programs with whom we contract with to place youth in residential care, 28 foster and proctor programs around the state, and about a $389 million budget. 1,000 employees, by the way. Most of our employees are in facilities. They're represented by SEIU, and our field staff, our JPPO staff, are represented by AFSCME. It's a map that shows you where our field offices and close custody facilities are located around the state. The red stars are close custody facilities. Several of those are camp programs, I might mention Camp Florence, which is in the chair's district.
Actually, it's not in the district, but that's real close to my practice.
Really, that's what I remembered, Senator.
Yes.
Thank you,
yes. Senator Roblin. Just for the record,
and it is the jewel of our close custody portfolio. It's right on the dunes there at Honeyman State Park. It's our only unfenced facility. It's a transition camp. Those of you that have been to McLaren know there's a perimeter fence. It's pretty high security, but there is a range in the close custody portfolio that we have, and Camp Florence is kind of the other end of that range, which is really basically a work release center for youth who are readying for transition. I should also mention in Linn County, the red star denotes two facilities on one campus, and it is our only facility for young women, the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility, and co-located there is the Young Women's Transition Program, which is a transition program for young women. Which we opened about a year ago. The facility itself was built with stimulus dollars but was never funded for staffing. We opened it kind of with duct tape and baling wire about a year ago as a pilot, and we're thrilled that the governor has proposed to open that facility permanently and permanently fund those positions so that we can put 25 young women in that program. which is badly needed. This is a map that shows you where our residential programs are located throughout the state. One of our great partners is in Senator Lithicum's district, the Klamath County Young Women's Program. That's an example of a residential program that's actually operated by a county government. Most of our residential partners are private nonprofits that also serve clients who are in DHS custody. The OYA population is a smaller population, but a very important one, and our residential providers are very important partners in our overall system. And then this often gets overlooked. We have a really robust foster care and proctor care program. These are the sites of our proctor and foster homes throughout the state. There are about 140 youth that are served in foster and proctor programs. These are really, really important players in our system. As you can imagine, there are a lot of youth that are committed to our care who simply do not have a family to go home to. And if they are not ready for independent living, we need to find them a place. And our foster parents are huge resources to what we do. I'm going to shift a little and talk a little bit about the demographics of the youth committed to our care. This pie on the left shows you the male to female breakdown of the rough age of jurisdiction 10 to 18 in Oregon, and the pie to the right shows you that our population in OYA is overwhelmingly male, proving what we all know, that girls are smarter than boys. A more troubling demographic slide is the disaggregation by race. The pie on the left shows you the racial and ethnic breakdown of the population, the youth population of Oregon as a state. And then on the right, it shows you the population broken down by race and ethnicity of youth who are committed to OYA. And you will see that the disproportionate over-representation of African-American goes from 2% statewide to 11% in OYA. You'll also see that the 3% to 11%, and the Native American population goes from 2% to 5%. If we were to granularize this a little bit more to just look at youth in close custody, the disparity becomes more acute. And if we were to break this down even more to show the youth who are committed through the adult court system, the disparity becomes even more acute. This is one of the most troubling demographic aspects and one that's vexed us for a very long time.
Do you have slides that show us that you're referencing, if we broke it out this way and if we broke it out that way? And probably for brevity's sake, you left those out. Could you provide those to us?
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, I'd be happy to. Yes, absolutely. You're exactly right. I left it out for brevity's sake because I promised council that we'd only take about 25 minutes in our overview. Another demographic slide. This shows you, basically, this shows you the hand that the youth have been dealt who come to us. And as you would suspect, there is a lot of trauma. There is a lot, you're all familiar with the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies. This bears out in our population. We know this information because we do a survey every 2 years of every single youth in our care, and we ask them this detailed set of questions. The highlights here, overwhelming drug and alcohol issues, overwhelming parental drug and alcohol issues, and overwhelming mental health issues, and among the young women, sexual abuse and past suicidal behavior.
Thank you. You had slides previous that broke out male and female,
yes,
and then race. Do you have this by race as well?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, that is a great question. I don't know. I hope we do, because we try to disaggregate everything that we can by race. I'll find that out. And if we have it, I'll submit it along with the deeper dive on disproportionate impact.
All right, Senator Denbrough.
Along those lines, do you break it out by socioeconomic metrics, low income?
Great question, Senator Chair Przanski, Senator Denbrough. I don't know if we do. I will find out. I suspect we don't have that information, but if I may, I'll get back to you on that as well.
Again, and this, you know, I don't offer this, and we don't offer this to say, oh, poor them, so much as to say, if we don't know as a system, if we don't know what happened to these young people, we're not going to be as effective in providing them the services they need to become productive and crime-free. Sorry, I'm going backwards on my slide. Here is a summary of the primary commitment offenses. So, you know, this gives you a sense of what the instigating reason for the court committing youth to OYA's care. And you can see that 30% of our population comes in for sex offenses. I've been asked this question a lot before about, as you know, in this committee, there are different categories of sex offenses that can be proven through forcible compulsion by reason of age, because of family. And we don't, I'm just going to preempt your question, we don't have data that is that deep around what subcategory each of the sex offenses of commitment are. But anecdotally, our POs tell us that the overwhelming majority is familial settings or by reason of age.
You know, on the one that you have drugs and alcohol related, 7% seems a little higher than I thought it would be. Can you give us a kind of just an overview of what type of crimes are being?
Sure. I'm Chair Przanski, the question about drugs and alcohol crime, that in this category, that would mean possession, that would mean distribution. Unlike the adult system that generally doesn't carry presumptive prison sentences for possession, right. Definitely doesn't for possession, and only in some cases does for distribution. The juvenile courts have broader discretion about whether or not to place a youth in close custody. Basically, if it's a Class A misdemeanor or higher, and the youth is older than 12, the court has discretion to place the youth in a correctional facility. That's why I say, unlike the adult system, we will see some kids that are adjudicated a possession of a controlled substance. Not a lot, but some. I suspect that the numbers behind that drug and alcohol related are more delivery and distribution related and manufacture. But I can find that out for you if you'd like to know deeper. Yeah, great. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Fairbors, who is going to talk to you about, if I can keep the slides going in the right direction, who's going to talk to you about some of our strategic initiatives that we are moving forward to try to bring juvenile justice in Oregon really to the next level.
Thanks, Joe. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'll do my best to stay within our time frame, briefly talking about our three strategic initiatives. And the first one is the youth reformation system, which begins to answer some primary questions. Like, are the right youth coming into the system? And does the system have enough capacity to serve them? Where should these youth be placed? And what kind of treatment and intervention they need to receive in order to address the issues that they faced that brought them to our system? If we are providing treatment and if we're spending money on these programs, are they being effective? And are we getting a good return on investment? And finally, what are the causes that bring youth to our system, to Oregon Youth Authority, and how do we return youth back into communities so that we actually don't create a revolving door, so that they don't come back into the system? The youth reformation system uses data, research, and predictive analytics to help us make decisions around these four pieces of this system, this continuum. And naturally, data and research does not provide the answers. They help information that then we can make decisions with. So it's really the professional discretion that's primary. And we do not take that away from the people who work as our staff and as professionals who've done this work for many years. The intent of this system is to reduce future victimization and maximize use of resources. The next slide shows some of the tools that have been developed as part of this system, which highlights that we actually are looking at the entire continuum rather than just Oregon Youth Authority. And I'll just highlight a couple of these tools. When we talk about the feeder system, it actually answers that first question as to, or that community context question, the first part of that question as to why are youth coming to us? And as we begin to dig deeper into that question with the tools and with the analytics that are available to us today, we can actually identify the trajectory of youth who are headed into our system very early on, perhaps even at birth. Some very basic information that is not going to surprise you is that as we do the research, what we find out is that there are three primary systems that send youth to us: alcohol and drug, foster care, and mental health. Another study that had been done just a couple of months ago is around identifying the causes of youth coming to us from the education system. It's also known as a school-to-prison pipeline. And interestingly, when you look at fifth graders, the number one cause of fifth graders headed into the juvenile justice system is moving from school to school during the school year. Now, that might be surprising, but who moves from school to school during the school year? Kids who are in foster care, kids who have parents who don't have enough resources to pay rent, and maybe family dynamics, neighborhoods, etc. We are continuing that study, and actually this project has happened as a result of sharing data with about a dozen other state agencies. Our partner, Department of Corrections, really have been at the table with us, and this is a joint project for both of us, but it's one of a kind in the nation as far as really looking at the entire continuum. And just very briefly, the escalation tool, which is the second tool, is applied to kids who are not yet at Oregon Youth Authority, but they've just been referred to the juvenile department. And at that point, this tool can be applied to identify the probability of that particular youth coming to our system, and then resources can be put around that youth to prevent his or her coming into our system. We're piloting that tool with Wasco County right now, and it has shown some very promising results. And then the predicted success rate is when the youth is actually at our doorstep, and while we're sitting with our county juvenile department partners and staffing together what is the best place for this youth so that we can take a recommendation to the court, that tool can be applied to help us decide what is the best place for that youth. Should he or she remain in the community? Is a residential placement the best place for that youth, or is OYA close custody? We are actually piloting that, now implementing that tool with all 36 counties in Oregon. I can talk about a lot of these other tools, but due to time, I'm not going to do that. But again, a very exciting project that allows us to use research data and analytics to help us make decisions. Back in 2013, we received a budget note from the legislature that specifically instructed us to implement the youth reformation system. And the intent of that budget note was to basically instruct us to create efficiency, maximize asset utility, create a timeline for the implementation of the youth reformation system, and not compromise the safety of youth or the community, and to the greatest extent, avoid layoffs. Those were the instructions. As a result of that, as we began implementing the youth reformation system, we realized that a big part of implementation is changing our own mindset and culture about how we deal with youth, about how we interact with youth. And it's been known for a long time that youth are different than adults, that the brain continues developing until age 25, for some of us perhaps longer. But what happens is that if we begin to treat youth like adults at 14, 15, 16, even at 20 and 24, we are creating a path that might not lead to success. And as a result of that, we implemented our culture change initiative, which is positive human development. It's rooted in supporting relationships, meaningful participation. At the core of this, at the base of this initiative is safety and security. That is the most important thing to our staff and to our youth. building on that, and we basically took a concept that is positive youth development, known nationally for many years, and we modified that because we wanted to include our staff in this process. And every part of this pyramid applies to both youth and staff. Caring and supportive relationships is at the heart of all of us being successful and feeling that we actually belong. At the heart of this pyramid is high expectations and accountability. We are not compromising on accountability. Meaningful participation is about the youth owning their future, owning their case plan, and the staff being responsible and owning what they do. And finally, it is community connection. When youth come to us as a result of crime that they have committed, as a result of gang involvement, their circle of belonging is very small. Our job is to expand that circle and include as many people in that circle as possible, and that community connection can happen on a living unit, in a facility, and ultimately in the broader community. Next couple of slides show what we are doing as a result of following directions around that 10-year facilities plan that the legislature asked us to do. As Joe said earlier, a major piece of that is closing Hillcrest and consolidating Hillcrest and McLaren. If you have been to Hillcrest, it's a beautiful campus, but it's a tiered structure looking much more like adult corrections and old buildings. And if we are actually following a developmental approach, then we need to have a different environment for our youth. It's an investment that will actually pay dividends down the road multiple times. When you look at this slide here, on the left you see a current intake unit at Hillcrest, and on the right you see a new intake unit at McLaren that will be completed by about July of this year. Again, natural lighting, much more developmental environment for youth that will help them in their affirmation and in their progress. The next slide is a classroom at Rogue Valley Correctional Institute in Grants Pass. Again, education is one of the main and primary components of success for youth. Currently, education happens within the living unit in those facilities, and we're building a high school that provides a much more normalized environment for kids to go to school, to learn, and research has shown that when you get your high school diploma, there was a study in Texas many years ago and actually updated just a couple of years ago, that the recidivism in Texas dropped from 62% to 24% with a high school diploma, to about 17% with a 2-year degree, about 7% with a bachelor's degree, and basically 0% with a master's degree. That's the impact of education. Again, it's an investment that pays dividend. So with that, I think we're staying within our allotted time, and Joe's going to talk about the bills in this legislative session.
It's the last slide, don't worry. we can do it. This is just a quick summary of some of the issues that are important to us and that we're monitoring as we go through. We're thrilled that Senate Bill 82 is on your docket here for this morning, and our Assistant Director for Development Services, Aaron Fuimaono, is here to talk to you about that bill and about the broader effort around reducing and preventing the use of isolation, that this bill is intended to be one prong of. That is our only agency bill. We are also following a variety of other issues that are reflected in measures so far that have been introduced this session. Obviously, anything that changes sentencing can be applicable to our population, so we follow that carefully. We're watching with interest a few measures that particularly focus on those DOC youth, that population that come to us, and for the most part, while they're with us, do really, really well. We're also following some bills that relate to the supervision of youth. That also relates to the supervision of DOC youth once they leave our gates. And then there are a variety of issues that bills that are on issues like education and the residential provider world and foster care that are usually written in a way that are applicable to
the broader community world and not so much the juvenile justice world. But we keep a close eye on those because they may have there may be some instances where they have an unintended effect on the juvenile justice world, or there may be an example where the juvenile justice population is unintentionally carved out of some of these bills, and you know, we want some consideration of the juvenile justice population to be included because it may benefit them, it may benefit therefore public safety. And I alluded to obviously our budget and how we are able to continue the momentum that we have around the 10-year plan and implementing our culture change initiative and implementing our research-based how to use data to inform decisions in a better way. So those are the issues we're looking at. We're happy to answer any other questions that you have before we leave you.
All right. Questions? Senator Dimbro first.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Gentlemen, in when I had conversations with young men and women who are currently or formerly in close custody, one of the experiences that I think that they've articulated as being really important for them is the opportunity to work and, you know, in many cases, you know, put into positions of some responsibility, and this is their first experience in many cases in their lives with work and responsibility and that kind of schedule. Could you say something about how prevalent that is in the, you know, in your conception of the OIA?
Yes. Chair Prozanski, Senator Dimbro. There are various opportunities for youth to work in Oregon Youth Authority. Depending on where they are, especially if they are a Department of Corrections youth that have mandatory sentencing, while they are with us and they're not eligible for being in a transition facility, they will do work within the fence. They might work in different areas of the facility. They could be working in our, if you've been to McLaren, we have a large vocational shop. They can learn skills, and we've invested heavily within the past couple of years to provide opportunities for living wage jobs. The challenge is really that normalized environment so that the best that we can do within the fence will never be the same experience as in the community. Now, if the youth have the opportunity, and generally Department of Corrections youth have the opportunity to go, depending on the type of crime that they have, to go to a transition camp within 18 or 24 months of release. As an example, when Joe was talking about Camp Florence, they actually work in the community. And we have a very strong relationship with businesses in Florence area. And they go out, and it's a much more normalized environment. They work, they come and spend the night in the facility and then go back and work again. In our transition facility in La Grande, we actually have a firefighting crew that goes out and helps Department of Forestry put out fires. That also provides real job experience for those youth, and some of them have been hired after doing that type of work. There's a variety of different licensing and certification programs for youth. We do the best that we can, but we can do better. There are additional opportunities, and depending on what might happen with, if there is such a thing as sentencing reform, or really looking at youth with a different lens than adults, then they could be provided more and better opportunities.
Excuse me, Senator Manning.
Chair, thank you. Thank you so much for this presentation. This is really important. I don't think that a lot of people understand the transformation that the Oregon Youth Authority and, you know, and the facilities and the staffing, how you have been moving it from a mere doing time to increasing opportunities for a better future. I know during my visit a few years ago, I had a chance to also visit Hillcrest as well. So one of the questions that I have, well, a couple of questions. I do know about the Oregon Youth Challenge Camp. If you had any chance or have any discussion about any kind of transitional programs with our youth, I mentored one young man that got involved with a, well, when he was going to school, gangs told him that if he didn't join the gang, they were going to beat him up every day. And, you know, in order for him to try to defend himself, he took a knife to school, and it was discovered that he got expelled. But the young man was smart enough that he wanted to continue his education, so he self-enrolled in the Oregon Youth Challenge Camp. And I was a mentor with him through that program, where he successfully completed it, and subsequently he graduated, got his degree, and he's interested in becoming a firefighter. I like the point that you're talking about, the opportunities to learn these skills in these different areas. But then when you come into the urban centers, what types of skills and transitional talents or education programs are you helping with that particular group of youth?
Chair Przanski, Senator Manny, thank you for that question. We do have the Youth Challenge Program is a great program. It is run by the Oregon Military Department. One of the great elements of it is the mentor requirement. Each youth needs to have a mentor. And I guess I'll open my response to your question with I wish that we had the capacity to do some kind of mentoring program, but that takes a certain level of resources that we're not quite at. What we do have with respect to your question about transitioning youth into jobs and education upon release, each youth is assigned a case manager who's committed to our care, a juvenile parole and probation officer. Those folks live and work in the community where the youth is going to return to. And it is their role to re-engage the youth who is either placed in a residential program outside their community or placed in a youth correctional facility when they're returning home to their home community, to re-engage them with educational opportunities and work and vocational opportunities. We also, over the last 2 years, have done a pilot where we have established a specialized crew of JPPOs, juvenile parole and probation officers, who focus just on vocational and education opportunities and really build networks. One of the great networks that we connected to for young women, I use it as an example. The Oregon Trades Women's Association connected us to a wonderful program that literally plugs youth into internships and apprenticeships as they're coming out of close custody. So we've got a lot of stuff like that, but that's definitely where we want to do more. The capacity to do more is great.
Just a quick follow. I appreciate that, and I do know another thing that during my visit that you're doing on-site certifications on fabrication of types of tools, and most of this is volunteer work and stuff. As I understand, you have a one of the area principals from one of the schools there that comes in and he donates his time and stuff to help. So how's that program going?
We're Chair Przanski, Senator Manning, thank you for asking about that. There's a couple of things. This committee can take credit for the electrician's apprenticeship program. You had a bill last session that allowed OYA to actually establish a credentialed pre-apprenticeship program for electricians in our facilities. First time we've ever done that. So that's part of that program that you referenced. And we're pretty entrepreneurial in taking advantage of opportunities. We leverage, as you alluded to, a lot of volunteers, and a lot of what we do is subsidized on the goodwill of volunteers who spend a lot of time, thousands of hours with our kids. We have great relationships with our education service districts, who are the contract providers of our high school education programs. The legislature also provides a certain amount of general fund for vocational education programs that go beyond secondary education, so we can leverage some of the education dollars with general fund dollars and do more. The community college program that you reference created the Moody Industrial Arts program that you toured on the McLaren campus is an example of the leveraging of a couple of different funding streams and some of our capital construction dollars to buy heavy equipment. We really look for, I think, Senator Thatcher, I think you've seen, you've probably seen the old version where this was a building where it was kind of used for the welding shop, and it was also kind of the welding shop and warehouse. It was full of like 30 or 40 years of stuff that had accumulated. We cleared it out. I think we used about 30 drop boxes to clear everything out of there. We purchased new industrial grade equipment. We used Chemeketa to help us create a curriculum. Some of OYA staff, some of our volunteers, and we also have an auto body and engine repair shop in that same building. And it's, I can't wait for you to see it, especially if you remember what it used to look like compared to what it looks like now. Is completely day and night different.
So I'm going to do some time management. We have another overview. We have a bill that we need to move today for y'all. So we can go offline and have continued communications. I know OYA will be more than glad to help work through this. I think we may be doing a tour or looking at trying to put one together, so it will give us another opportunity to have more hands-on. So, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so we are going to go ahead and close the overview on the Oregon Youth Authority. We're going to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 82. And Whitney, why don't you give us an overview, please?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 82 is brought to us at the request of the Oregon Youth Authority. Senate Bill 82 would create a policy in Oregon prohibiting the use of isolation as a sanction or punishment at an OYA facility. It would also expand existing law to include all persons in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, not just youth offenders. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right, thank you. And we don't have your name on the sign-in, so I'm going to write it in for you. But if you'll be so kind to introduce yourselves, and we'll make certain we have all the records done.
Chair Przanski, for the record, Joe O'Leary, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm not going to try to spell her name, but with me at the table is Aaron Fuima Ono.
He's really good at pronouncing it now.
Okay. We'll put Aaron, we'll fill in the rest of this later.
I know my limitations.
All right. Y'all like to go ahead and...
Mine too. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, it is my privilege to introduce Aaron. She's our assistant director of the newly created Development Services Division. She's started her career with us 23 years ago as a direct care staff and is really one of our stars. And she has been working this issue for the last 18 months or so on what we can do as an agency to help prevent and reduce the use of isolation in our youth correctional facilities.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, as Joe said, I'm Aaron Fuima Ono. I'm here to provide some background information about OYA's efforts to reduce the use of isolation and to describe Senate Bill 82, which is a key piece of that effort. OYA has been taking an intentional and multifaceted approach to reducing the use of isolation for the last several years. Our strategy has really focused on thoughtful implementation of a culture shift so that we can support sustainable change around the use of isolation and also ensure that any additional resources are used as intended. In October 2014, we established an internal isolation oversight committee, which focused on redefining when and how youth may be placed in isolation based on research and best practice, identifying resources to support recommended changes so that they can be implemented and sustained, and aligning related OYA rules, policies, and practices. In April 2015, we established the External Use of Isolation Community Advisory Group, which is comprised of advocacy groups and content experts in juvenile justice and mental health. This external committee provides ongoing review and feedback of our internal oversight committee's recommendations, and it includes representation from Youth Rights and Justice, Disability Rights Oregon, Partnership for Safety and Justice, a child psychiatrist, a juvenile court judge, a juvenile detention manager, a district attorney, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Commission on Black Affairs. Some of our major accomplishments to date include a recommendation and plan for implementation of a revised threshold for use of isolation that would limit the use of isolation to only incidents where violence is imminent or where violence has occurred. An active implementation plan to support culture change around the use of isolation. Revised documentation to more accurately record reasons for isolation. The development of skill building and reintegration processes focused on reintegrating youth back into their living unit communities after an isolation episode, and piloting the use of reintegration skill development coordinator staff to facilitate those processes, which helps us limit the length of time a youth spends in isolation and also support the youth's successful return to their living unit community. We've also used those staff to help create in-between spaces for youth who may need a break from a group living environment. They may be starting to get dysregulated, but their behavior hasn't escalated to the point of requiring an isolation intervention. And so those skill development staff can create some spaces and have staffing for those spaces so that youth can have a place to go to get some support, create a plan for how they're going to manage their emotions and return to the living unit without ever having to be placed in isolation. The governor's budget would make this pilot and the funding for these staff permanent, and we do believe that that staffing is vital to decreasing the use of isolation. And finally, we consider the development of Senate Bill 82 as one of our major accomplishments. So essentially, Senate Bill 82 puts into law that a sanction or punishment cannot include placing a youth in isolation. It's a way to codify a long-time OIA policy that prohibits the use of isolation as a punishment, and it supports our efforts to see isolation as just a very small piece of a youth safety intervention continuum. We and our external advisory committee felt that it was really important to put this cornerstone of our practice into law, and that is what Senate Bill 82 proposes. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from anyone on the for the panel? Senator,
a curiosity, the culture shift and the thoughtful use of this, it sounds to me like this is internal to your organization and doesn't require the legislature to step in and make it a, quote, a law. And so I'm wondering why your culture change doesn't just blossom within your organization. Do you really have a statistical problem with overuse of isolation? And do we have evidence for the impact that that has on kids, et cetera? This seems like I often feel like Oregon becomes a nanny state, and now we're nanny stating ourselves. And so I'm curious why the impetus to put this in law. And then the other thing that strikes me about this legislation is it's very simple and generic in this concept of custody of youth alone in a locked room. Just, it's hard for me, not being part of the industry, to wrap my head around what that actually entails, what the definition looks like.
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, great questions. I think we're going to tag team them. I'll take the one about why not just leave it as a policy, why codify it, and I'll let Aaron talk to you a little bit more about the frequency of isolation. Maybe he can give you a flavor of that, and what something great that you've touched on about the definition in the business of juvenile justice, because there are some states that say we've eliminated isolation, and when you dig into it, you find out that they really haven't. It's just they define it differently. The answer to your why codify this question, really largely two reasons. One is entrenchment, basically. Under this administration and this director, this policy is not going to change. So you're right. There's really no imminent reason to codify the policy change, but we all know administrations change. And the reason to put it in statute is that I will note there is a statute that speaks to the use of isolation for juvenile detention facilities, which are the local short-term facilities, and there is no such statute with respect to youth correctional facilities. So there is a gap that exists now. Arguably, if this remains only as an internal policy, a future administration could determine that the notwithstanding all the brain science and research to the contrary, that the developmental approach isn't the way to go, and you know, putting kids in locked rooms for mouthing off to a staff person is an okay response. I would submit to you that it is an important enough issue that it is worthy of codification in statute. That's the question, or that's the answer to that part of the question.
Follow on with that. Excuse me, I went squeaky there for a second. With that, there appears there's a little bit of a disconnect. There's no if it were policy, there would be some remedial action to point and say it's against the law. There's still no enforcement or remedial action or criminal, you know, conduct going on here. So if it's embedded in the culture and you're trying to change the culture, granted, and great, keep at it, pointing to and saying it's against the law, you can't do that, or pointing to the rule book and saying it's against our policy, you can't do that. I'm trying to weigh the difference.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Litham, appreciate that, and there is no there's no civil liability directly that would flow, though I would say that the you know, the agency is taking on additional risk, knowing that isolation is already part of the policy. There's risk there if we weren't to follow that policy, but if it's also a statute, that just seems to increase the risk if we don't follow it. But you're right, there's absolutely no criminal liability or anything like that. If it's a rule, it's a statute. I appreciate your point. I think, you know, my response is this is the direction we're going. We would like to solidify that momentum so that it is harder to change in the future, frankly. You know, the other element to answer your question is that
Joe, I'm going to need to we're going to have to kind of wrap up. I've got another group that's supposed to be here. We're at 33 minutes, and that's actually borrowing time. So I'm going to ask for that to go offline. I just think that, you know, and what we may want to do is adjust our time. I thought that, you know, starting at 8:30, we may want to start earlier just to make certain we have enough time for more questions being answered and stuff like that.
We'll catch each other later and talk about it. All right. Without the committee present. Happy to do so.
All right.
Did you want us to speak to numbers, or would you like to hold that till offline?
Personally, I'd like to do it offline because I have another person that has indicated they want to give testimony today, which was not on the list. And so I'm trying to manage based on what I know walking the door. And now I understand we have other people, and I can't cut them off, or don't want to cut them off, I should say. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So Kimberly McCullough.
Good morning. My name is Kimberly McCullough. I work with the ACLU of Oregon, and I'm sorry that I didn't get myself on the list this morning. I somehow forgot since it's been so long. I'll keep my comments very short because I know that there's pressing time, but I just want to let you all know that, and many of you probably already know this, that ending the use of solitary confinement for youth is extremely high priority for us. We want our youth facilities to keep youth healthy and help them grow into productive adults and not suffer the sometimes irreparable damage that can happen because of solitary. Because of how much we care about this, we were extremely happy that OYA was very proactive. They reached out to us. They asked us to participate in the community group, the advisory group. They made it a very collaborative process. They've been extremely transparent and open. And I basically just wanted to come up here to let you guys know that from a community perspective, this has been a really great process. In addition, I just wanted to emphasize that I think that OYA really is a great example for the rest of the country on how to transform their practices in this regard. And I think that's part of the reason why codification is so important because this really does send a message to the rest of the country. This is a problem that is across our nation, and there actually are a lot of states that are looking to Oregon and seeing our example, and it's inspiring them. So I think that's just one more reason to do it. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We're not going to do a work session today. I'm going to allow for members to have this off time to talk before we go for a vote. So I want to respect each member's having the opportunity to get the information before we vote on that bill. So we will reschedule the work session for Senate Bill 82 probably for next week. Hopefully that will give everyone enough time to fill in the blanks. All right. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our informational hearing on the Department of Corrections. And Colette, I understand you're coming up. I'm not sure if you have anyone helping or you're on your own.
Just me.
All right.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and it is a pleasure to be here this morning. As a point of order, Mr. Chair, do we have just until 10 o'clock?
Actually, a little less than 10 o'clock because I need to allow members out so they can do what they need to do, get back to their offices for whatever they have probably scheduled at 10 o'clock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. On Monday, I celebrated my fifth year as director of the Department of Corrections, and our team has accomplished so much, so I would be happy to spend the entire morning with you bragging about what they've done and the challenges that are ahead, but I will try to be as brief as possible as we move forward. Or not. I'll start with our base, our foundation. Our mission is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of criminal behavior. Our mission is something we do every day, something many of you are familiar with. Everyone in our organization focuses on this mission, even if they're not directly working with those in our care and custody. The first part of our mission is something that we have refined over the years, yet holding offenders accountable at the Department of Corrections is simply more in our minds than carrying out the court orders. It really is focusing on their reformation and their treatment while they are in our care. The second half of our mission is just as important. It is to reduce the likelihood that individuals will commit another crime after release. What this means for me is that another victim is not created, and as a former victim's advocate, that piece is never lost on me. Our business model is the Oregon Accountability Model. It keeps us really focused on our path to success from day one in prison to the day of release and through community supervision. So we use data to determine risk in order to appropriately case plan. We foster a culture of accountability and respect amongst our staff and those in our care and custody. This means that we don't hire guards at the Oregon Department of Corrections. We hire corrections officers, corrections professionals, who role model pro-social behavior, redirect negative behavior, and reinforce positive behavior in a fair and humane way. We focus on evidence-based programs, we focus on children, families, and transition, and we focus on appropriate treatment, sanctions, and community support upon reentry. So while our business philosophy, the Oregon Accountability Model, remains the same since we last met, we have added another system that complements this philosophy. And we will talk about that more here in a minute. DOC is responsible for the care and custody of more than 14,600 adults incarcerated in 14 prisons scattered throughout the state. These individuals have been convicted of felonies and sentenced to more than 1 year in custody. Just quickly, some of our demographics, 92% of those in our care and custody are men, 41% are between the age of 31 to 45. Like the Oregon Youth Authority, 75% of those in our care and custody are Caucasian, 9% are African American, as opposed to the 2 to 3% in Oregon's general population, 12% are Hispanic, compared to the general population of 8%, 68% are in on person crimes, 82% have some mental health need, and 70% have some substance abuse issue. We have a lot of people coming in and out of our organization. Almost 400 individuals are returned to our communities every month, and 93% of those who are sentenced to our care and custody ultimately return to Oregon's communities. We are very proud of our state-run community corrections teams in Douglas and Linn County. I would like to highlight one area of focus this last year, which was increasing the amount of victim restitution collected in those two counties by our officers by 17%. So this was a great success that came out of our performance-based management system, and I'll talk about that here in just a minute. In addition to this direct oversight in those two counties, we also have indirect oversight of more than 31,000 adults on felony probation, parole, and post-prison supervision in a very strong collaboration with our remaining 34 counties. We also have a strong partnership with our two labor organizations, AOCE and AFSCME. And overall, we have a $1.8 billion budget to carry out our agency's functions. And it is not lost on me that that dollar amount is almost exactly equal to the budget deficit of which you are faced. Our performance-based management system. In an effort to become more transparent and accountable, we have implemented a performance-based management system at the Oregon Department of Corrections. We call it CORE, which stands for Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement, and it really is allowing us to become a more transparent and outcome-based agency. Equally of importance to me, it really is empowering our employees, our 4,500 employees, to feel empowered to come forward with improvements for change. We developed a strong set of core values that support that mission and that business strategy that I talked about earlier, and then we created an agency-wide scorecard. This is just an example of what it looks like. We use our scorecard to track the process measures on our fundamentals map, and as an agency executive team, we review the scorecard every quarter and go line by line as we review over 108 total measures. So this is just a small example of the number of measures we look at. And I thought you'd be interested to know that we look at things like the number of adults in custody completing GEDs, to staff wellness, to training, to DOC team member grievances. After we really focused on the core of our business, and defined really who we are, then we wanted to focus on what are our issues. Where do we want to take the agency? And so we created a strategic vision that we're calling Destination 2026, and we are holding ourselves accountable to what I think could be seen as a lofty outcome. We hope that in 10 years, we will be the public safety employer of choice, with innovative employees who come to work every day knowing that they can transform lives, both the lives of those in our care and custody and of each other. And I'll talk about staff wellness here in a bit, and you'll understand why that part is so important to me. We're going to hold ourselves accountable with 1- and 2-year goals, a four-year check-in to recalibrate where we are to ensure that we get to that place in 10 years. The plan has, as you can see, I'm going to back up. The plan actually has five categories, five roads that we're calling to get us to Destination 2026. And the first is people and skills. We know that we have some of the hardest working public safety professionals in the business, working inside our prisons and in our communities. These jobs are stressful, they're demanding, they're taxing, and we have difficulty recruiting, retraining, and promoting. So this part of our roadmap is all about instilling pride in our staff, helping the public understand how much we value our corrections professionals. We want to provide world-class training and recruit the best and the brightest with a passion for corrections. The entire state is faced with a massive retirement in the near future. It's compounded at the Department of Corrections because 20 to 25 years ago, we built a whole bunch of prisons, and those team members stayed with us. So 52% of my team can retire within the next 3.5 years. Many of them are watching your PERS conversations very closely. So since So we've had a breakthrough team, a workforce planning development team, that's one of our top initiatives, and they've realized some great successes already. We have a better understanding now of data in regards to retention. We have developed a recruitment strategy. We're using social media to reach out to folks and get them into our organization. And we're even piloting some mentoring programs for our new staff at some of our institutions. We know that we cannot get to 2026 without our employees. They're our everything. And staff wellness is our top agency initiative. This is an issue I'm very passionate about. Many of you heard me have talked about this. I've been in public safety for 25 years. I was drawn to this field because it's a helping field. I believe in the fact that people can change. I've worked with juveniles and victims and push to drive policy and data to make good decisions. And yet it took me 25 years to figure out that we have completely overlooked the people, the professionals that are doing the helping. When I came on board as director 5 years ago, we looked up and realized that in an 18-month period, we had lost 4 team members to suicide. And we had never studied the issue. And so we called upon OHSU and PSU to come in and look at the data, and the statistics were startling. We have 1 in 3 of our staff members that have symptoms of PTSD. 90% are obese or overweight. Nearly that number have hypertension or pre-hypertension. And the scary thing for the doctor that was doing the research, he noted that when he met with the staff members, they didn't realize how grave their own personal statistics were. So we've worked very hard to focus on this issue at the Department of Corrections. I could spend all day talking about what we've done, but in the interest of time, I will just let you know that not only has it become a top priority in Oregon, but because of Oregon's efforts, it's now become a top priority with the American Correctional Association, the National Institute of Corrections, and the Association of State Correctional Administrators. Culture. Every organization needs to keep its pulse on its culture. Even more important when the organization is charged with the behavior change of violent and serious offenders. So given that, if our staff are not well, as I was just talking about, we will not get to Destination 2026. Also in this vein, Portland State University, their research while they were studying our staff's wellness, revealed that the one thing that can change our staff's wellness comes without cost, really. All it takes is for that frontline employee to have their frontline supervisor value them and value their family. And so we are placing an emphasis on valuing employees and families. We're bringing families into our organization to see what it looks like on the inside of a prison and talk to them about risk factors and what they should look for in supporting their family members who work for us. Many of you have heard me talk about some of the positive outcomes we have experienced in Oregon's public safety system. We have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country. We operate comparatively very safe prisons. We rely on evidence-based programs in prison and in the community. And we recognize we can and should do better. So this area of our strategic plan is all about increasing positive outcomes. We will be focusing on safe and secure workplaces, ensuring that the adults in our custody are placed in the right housing situations, modernizing technology, and ultimately reducing future victimization. And last, but certainly not least, reentry and supervision. In my 25 years in public safety, I have always been a firm believer in accountability, rehabilitation, and the obligation to help individuals prepare for successful reentry back to the community. That's what we all want. We all want them to be tax-paying, healthy citizens in our community. And what we do in corrections echoes the Oregon Constitution. First and foremost, we protect public safety. Secondly, we hold offenders accountable and require them to take personal responsibility for what we've done. And third, we allow for rehabilitation or reformation through those programs and services. This combination ultimately contributes to that successful reentry. So we're focusing on those in our custody meeting the goals of their case plan, so they leave DOC with the skills they need to be that successful Oregonian. We rely on evidence-based programs that meet identified criminogenic needs, and that those in custody and those on supervision pay towards their court-ordered financial obligations. So now that I've taken you out 10 years, I would like to get you back to today and wrap up quickly, Mr. Chair, which brings me to the next topic, which is legislation. Now, we have 12 pieces of legislation that we brought forward this legislative session. I'm not going to go through all of those this morning. Instead, I just want to highlight one of ours and one that this committee has been gracious enough to bring forward, and I'll start with that bill. This is a bill that was the result of the Inmate Financial Accountability Work Group. This was a group that DOC chaired and staffed, and that included a very diverse group of stakeholders, all with one goal: to develop a system whereby DOC can collect a portion of inmate monies to go toward court-ordered obligations such as victim restitution, fines and fees. And while, as I said earlier, this is not a DOC bill, it is something very important to our agency. We don't even have the technology right now to make that happen. And so we appreciated everyone's assistance on that work group and the collaborative effort to get where we are. The second is House Bill 2251, which is a concept I worked on with OIA Director Fairbors Paksuresh. And this would codify our longstanding practice of not housing anyone under the age of 18 in DOC custody. So prior to being the director of the Department of Corrections, I was the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And at that time, we had a practice in place where if youth misbehaved at the Oregon Youth Authority, we would send them to the Department of Corrections, not for a new crime, but for their behavior. Former Director Max Williams, as the director of DOC, and I at OIA, with my good deputy Fairbors Paksuresh, put an end to that immediately and said their behavior problems are our problems, not the Department of Corrections. And so this changes an existing statute that allows for that transfer to happen and says and codifies that we will no longer engage in that practice. This aligns with federal sight and sound regulations and with best practices across the country. So with that, that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know I went fast. Mr. Chair.
Questions for from anyone?
Yeah.
Paulette, thank you very much. I just want to just recognize not only Paulette, but Fairbors. Both of these individuals are unique individuals. They are both golden, platinum, titanium stars. And I can tell you there's been hedge hunters and others around the country who've been kind of wanting to see if they could lure them away from Oregon. I'm hoping they don't. And I thank both of you for being here and bringing forward the change and shifts in culture that actually is going to give more public safety and more positive outcomes for the communities. So thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Very kind comments, and you're stuck with me.
That's great.
All right. Okay, so with that, we'll close the overview on the DOC, and let's see, at this point, we're going to go into public hearings on Senate Bill 15 is the next one I believe we have. So, Whitney?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 15 was brought to us by the Department of Corrections. Currently, the Superintendent of State Police is authorized to appoint DOC employees as special state police officers to assist with medical transport. Senate Bill 15 would expand the superintendent's authority to appoint DOC employees to assist in all DOC transport functions. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Brian?
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, I'm Brian Bilek, Deputy Director for the Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 15 and answer any questions. SB 15 expands the authority of the Oregon State Police Superintendent to appoint DOC transport employees as special state police officers to assist in all department transport functions and duties. Current statute states that the Superintendent of State Police may appoint DOC employees as special state police officers if the superintendent deems it necessary or advisable to assist DOC in DOC's medical transport functions and duties. We have a longstanding agreement with state police and a practice of allowing DOC transport staff to carry firearms when they conduct any transport functions and duties, not just medical. Transports can occur for medical reasons, extraditions, simply moving an adult in custody to another facility, and courtroom visits. Amending statute would enforce current practice and eliminate any confusion. If passed, this legislation would amend ORS 181.263 to expand the existing authority of the state police superintendent to designate DOC transport employees as special state police officers, which would assist DOC in the discharge of all its transport functions, such as medical trips, extraditions, courtroom supervision and security, and interstate transfers. Public safety best practices require the extra layer of security in the community, which helps protect the courts, the public, and law enforcement personnel. This also mitigates potential litigation in the event of a justified discharge of a firearm to prevent escape, death, and or serious injury. For the reasons explained above, the department asked this committee to vote Senate Bill 15 out of committee with a do pass recommendation. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you, Brian. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
First, I want to say I don't have any problem with the bill, but I do question, why can't they just be Department of Corrections people? Why do they have to be appointed as special state police officers?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, due to the requirements of the extra precautions of escorting out in the community, we provide those transport staff with higher level of training in firearms and qualifying to the state police standards in weapons use and retention.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Brian, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on SB 15?
Thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up the next public hearing. We can come back to vote. I just want to try to allow individuals to get their testimony in so we don't have them needing to come back. So we'll open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 184.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 184 was also brought to us at the request of the Department of Corrections. Currently, the superintendent of DOC is able to allow inmates to sell small handiwork items to the public at a DOC institution. Senate Bill 184 removes the requirements that these crafts may only be sold to the public at DOC institutions. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal impact. There is a minimal revenue impact.
All right. And, Roger, I have you down that want to testify as well. If you do, please come forward. Heidi, go ahead.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, I am Heidi Stewart, the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And for the sake of time, I am going to make this very quick. You have my written testimony, or my electronic testimony in front of you. Essentially, the department drafted this bill, Senate Bill 184, to update existing statute describing the sale of inmate-made goods in Oregon. We support the bill. The statutory language, we're basically asking that the statutory language be updated so that we can use modern technology to sell inmate goods. So we urge the committee to pass the bill and move it out of committee. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Roger?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. We strongly support a number of pieces of legislation that the division has talked to you about. Specifically, I wanted to give you an example of inmate art. Those two items were made for me within the last year. The belt is especially interesting. It is a horse hair belt, valued, if you put the inmate's time in at normal wages, somewhere around $2,000. It's historical. It's a perfect example of inmate art. This started, the technique of building, making these horsehair belts started in the territorial prison in Arizona over 160 years ago. It has migrated north, and the headquarters of this art form now are the Montana State Prison. And my friend, the inmate that made this belt, learned it over the internet and in telephone calls with an inmate at Montana State Prison. We formerly had a hobby shop available, or a craft shop available to the public near the penitentiary, the OSP, that was taken out by State Street expansion. There are a number of very talented people who work on art, not only this kind, but pictures and other things that ought to be able to sell. We have a modern way of selling on the internet. We ought to recognize that. I urge you to pass this bill.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone? All right, thank you all very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 184, and we're going to try to squeeze in the testimony on Senate Bill 14. Josh, why don't you go ahead, and the two, Jeremiah, you're coming up, and it's Chris, also Hoy.
He needed to leave.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 14 reduces the frequency with which the Department of Corrections reviews the county's compliance with their community corrections plan. We have the paperwork. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right. Thank you. Jeremiah?
Great. Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director of the Community Corrections Division with the Department of Corrections. What this bill does is it allows us to continue to hold the counties responsible and accountable to how they spend the more than $240 million in grant and aid services for parole and probation within the counties, and yet allows us to do something that's more thorough, more of a better product, if you will, for the counties if we are doing this once a biennium and not attempting to evaluate all 36 community corrections agencies every year as statute currently outlines. Therefore, we're asking that you change the language from annually to biennially, which will allow us to continue to hold them accountable, continue to ensure that those monies are being spent appropriately, and in doing so, being able to report back to the legislature as to how those monies are being spent. And with that, we ask for a due pass recommendation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, any questions from anyone? All right, the one comment I will make, Jeremiah, and I had an opportunity with others from DOC to talk. This is actually going to not only take off that, let's say, that weight of doing it annually, but they'll be able to go in greater detail in a two-year review.
Yes.
That they'll spend much more time instead of trying to just beat the clock, as we are today, on an annual basis.
That's absolutely correct.
All righty. And I think we beat the clock, so thank you very much. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 14. Not sending, we'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, what we're going to do is we'll go ahead and get these rescheduled for for work sessions. And I'm sorry that I kind of cut off the conversation on OYA. So I want to make certain all the members have an opportunity to hear from OYA on any other part of their bill on Senate Bill 82. And then we'll get these scheduled. The goal will be to try to have these fit in this next week. We'll speak with staff and we'll get this covered. So thank you very much for being here, and we're going to adjourn. Oh, tomorrow, 8 o'clock, we do have an early start because we do have a much more fuller schedule than what we've planned before. We're adjourned.